All right, in case some of you don't know me, I think I know a lot of people out here. My name is Mark Shattuck. I'm at the City College of New York and the Benjamin Levitch Institute. And I'm going to talk to you today about granular fluid dynamics. And I want to first give my definition of granular materials. And it hopefully is going to get you starting to think in the way that I try to think about granular materials. And that is that granular material is a collection of particles. Each particle has a lot of internal degrees of freedom. Okay? So if you think about all the modes in this collection of sand, let's say, you know, there's 10 to the 26 total modes, include all the particles, all the atoms and so forth in there. But there's a very, very small fraction of those modes, namely the translational degrees of freedom of the center of mass of each one of those particles, that are kind of special. And they're special in the sense that we're easily able to excite them well above the energy level of all the other modes. So if you have sand sitting in a dish and you start shaking it up and down, you don't heat it up, you don't heat up the temperature of the system. Well, a little bit you do, but not very much because there's so many modes. But this small subset of modes, the translational degrees of freedom and the rotational degrees of freedom, maybe some other modes, a few more, but still nothing approaching the 10 to the 26 that you have for the whole system, those are all getting very, very highly excited. And really, the study of granular systems is then inherently an out-of-equilibrium study, but in a system where you can get non-equilibrium steady states. So if you continue to put energy into these translational degrees of freedom, some of it leaks out back to the internal modes, which we usually characterize by coefficient of restitution or by friction or some other loss mechanism. But you reach sometimes a steady state in this system. And one of the questions is, can we treat that steady state of this small fraction of modes like a thermodynamic system, like an ordinary fluid, like we would treat kinetic theory of any system like that? So that's my kind of definition of granular materials. That's a very general definition. Includes many, many things. Anything with internal degrees of freedom, essentially, where you can excite some small number of those. But in specific, what I really study is the absolute simplest version of this, okay? And so I look at dry, and by dry I mean really dry. Very often we use vacuum to get out any trace of any interaction with the fluid. Cohesionless particles, so these are just perfect hard spheres. They don't have any attractive potential. And rapidly flowing, okay? And this is really one of the key issues in terms of how we think about granular systems is what is really the definition of rapid? And how rapid does it have to be? And, you know, is the granular kinetic energy compared to the granular potential energy, is that the right number? What is the number that's going to tell us whether something is rapidly flowing? One interesting thing is that for a perfect hard sphere system without gravity, there's no energy scale in the system. And so time is totally irrelevant. So rapid means absolutely nothing. Okay, so all perfect hard sphere systems have to act the same on all time scales. So for perfect hard spheres, this is not really a question, but obviously we don't have perfect hard spheres, but is that where this kind of breaks down? Where does it break down? And that's one of the things that we try to understand. Okay, so with that brief introduction to granular systems, let me give you my introduction to the way I think about these kinds of systems. And this also could really be my conclusion slide. So, you know, after you've seen this, you've really seen, you know, what I'm going to say, but I'll try to support some of these ideas as we go through. And the first is that rapid dilute granular flows, or these types I'm talking about, act like Newtonian fluids, essentially. But they're under extreme conditions. Things like high Mach number, things like near solid fluid phase boundaries, and so they're easily able to be frozen, easily able to be melted. They're moving at very high speeds compared to their internal motions, okay, which is what high Mach number means. But even though we're in these extreme conditions, we still maybe can define some kind of granular thermodynamics for these systems. And in these systems, equilibrium has to be replaced by some kind of non-equilibrium steady state. Okay, so you replace equilibrium with a situation of non-equilibrium steady state. And this is more than just for the non-equilibrium steady state, because we use equilibrium in ordinary fluids a lot. We don't always look, Navier-Stokes equation doesn't tell us anything about equilibrium systems, it tells us about systems out of equilibrium, but that are locally in equilibrium. So the analogous thing would be that there would be some local non-equilibrium steady state in the granular system that we can treat like a equilibrium system in ordinary fluids. And under that sort of situation, then we should be able to define things like a phase diagram, where we have the pressure of a system, we have an input of energy as a control parameter, we can find a gas state, we can find a crystalline state. If we set at a particular pressure, we would go along, and as we heat the system up, it would be a crystal, and then all of a sudden it would become a gas. And we'd have some kind of equation of state that would tell us about the relationship between some of these state variables. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And let me first just give you some indications that this kind of thing might be feasible. Okay, this is a relatively old experiment. It's a very simple experiment. You take a dish of sand and start shaking it up and down. When you do, you have patterns that form, these sloshing patterns that slosh back and forth. Here's a picture of such a pattern. And you can see peaks being formed and valleys being formed. As you slosh this around, the peaks become valleys and the valleys become peaks. You have pictures like this. You can get these space-filling patterns. You can get localized patterns, which are called oscillons. Here in both of these pictures, we're looking in from the side. Here we're looking down on top of an oscillon. Here's looking down on this pattern from the top. And what you can see is that this looks a lot like a fluid. This looks like a splash and looks very much like a fluid. And if you blur your eyes, you can really hardly distinguish it from an ordinary fluid. But on the other hand, if you focus in, you can clearly see the molecules of this fluid. Okay, so we're on a very different scale from ordinary fluids, but that doesn't mean they can't act like ordinary fluids. Now, this is a very complicated experiment and gets a huge number of patterns. I've just shown a small collection here, squares, stripes, hexagons. All of these patterns exist. There are many, many more patterns that exist, including the oscillons, phase bubbles, phase domain patterns, all sorts of things in the phase diagram of this system. And one of the amazing things is that you can reproduce all of this quantitatively with a very, very simple model. Okay? And the very simple model is a hard sphere model which conserves momentum but dissipates energy. And these collisions are binary collisions, but it's for this type of system, it's enough to quantitatively reproduce this kind of experiment. So that's the same basic starting point that we have for kinetic theory. For ordinary materials, is a hard sphere binary system. And it can reproduce this very, very complicated system. And so people like Jim Jenkins and others have developed Navier-Stokes-like equations for these systems. And we have, just like in an ordinary fluid, we have a conservation of mass equation, a conservation of momentum equation, where the momentum pressure tensor is a Newtonian pressure tensor. Okay, so up to here, it's exactly the same as in an ordinary fluid. The difference comes in the fluctuational energy balance. For ordinary materials, we have a conservation of energy equation. Here, we just have a balance. And this is where the non-equilibrium steady state comes in. There's a temperature loss rate that takes energy out of the system. And there's ways to create energy through boundaries, through either conduction or through compressional or dilational heating. Okay. And it's a balance between these that takes the place of the temperature equation in granular systems. This has a profound effect on what happens in granular systems. And that is that granular systems are very, very quickly moved towards a situation where they have a high Mach number. And by high Mach number, I mean that if I push on the granular gas and ask how long does it take that information that I push to propagate across the system, that speed is very slow compared with other speeds in the system, like the speed that an object might be moving through, or even the speed of the individual grains themselves. So what you have is a very simple picture. In a low Mach number fluid, you have the green trajectory of an individual particle with some mean flow that goes along in the red direction. This gives you a velocity distribution which is broad and centered near zero. The mean is a little bit off to give you this slow drift, but this width is very broad compared to that. In a granular system, because you have this temperature loss rate, the temperature is just the width, the square root of the width of this distribution. That width gets thinner and thinner and thinner, and you end up with a situation like this, where the mean velocity is much, much larger than the width in the distribution. And that is a picture like this, where you have trajectories that move along essentially in the same way as the mean flow does. And it's in that situation that many granular systems exist, and it has a profound effect on how we treat these systems, because we're in a very different regime. Normally, for Navier-Stokes equation, in ordinary materials, we simply ignore the Mach number. It's just too small to even matter. In granular systems, it's a dominant effect. And you can see this in an experiment like this, where we take a wedge and we rain particles down, 2D experiment, we rain particles down between two glass plates separated by about one particle diameter, and we use particle tracking to find the particles. And what you can see is there's a distinct change in behavior following along this line. This is a shock line, or a shock, just like you'd get in an ordinary gas. Here's an average picture of the horizontal velocity in this thing. So zero horizontal velocity out here, moving this way on this side, moving this way on this side. And you see this nice sharp change in behavior denoting a shock forming in this system. This is what you would get for an elastic hard spheres. Okay, so it's virtually the same as what you get in inelastic hard spheres, except you can see the angle is a little bit lower, that goes out a little bit further here. And we are able to get quantitative agreement between our experiment and our molecular dynamics simulations, and between our molecular dynamics simulations and our Navier-Stokes equations. And I won't talk about this today, but there's a technical reason why we weren't able to compare directly with the experiments. But that kind of situation is essentially the most favorable to this viewpoint. Okay, it's very dilute, very rapid, and so, yes?
So, when you look at the splash like that,
yes.
The oscillants,
yes.
The analogous with liquid, do you have the same, don't the capillary force?
In liquids, it's very difficult to get into the regime that we are in granular systems, because there is no capillary interaction. So if you take water and do this, instead of getting patterns that don't depend on the shape of the container, you get patterns that are essentially modes of the surface tension. Now, if you go to very, very large systems, or you go to very, very high viscosity, or other situations, you can eliminate the capillary forces as the dominant force and get to the gravity wave. When you get to the gravity wave, you do get oscillon-like behaviors, although there's nothing quite as clean as the oscillon that you get in this experiment. Sure, absolutely. Yes.
You said it's ordinary gas dynamics for each of these type experiments, or is it a fine tension number? Do you need verified things?
That's one actually interesting point. In ordinary Navier-Stokes equation, we'll get everything right except what happens at the tip. Okay. And there, there's a situation where you can see that the molecular dynamics gets the tip perfectly fine, but the Navier-Stokes does not get it right. In granular or in ordinary fluids, it doesn't get it right. And the reason is that at this tip, the velocity distribution is no longer unimodal. Okay, there are particles that have come down, have never seen the tip. So you have a big distribution of particles going this way down. Then there are particles that have bounced off going this way, so you have a big distribution over here, another big distribution over here. So you have a trimodal distribution of velocities in that system. Navier-Stokes takes the Boltzmann equation's distribution of velocities and says, I will just track three numbers associated with that distribution. The area, which is the density, the mean, which is the velocity, and the width, which is the temperature. So I'll try to describe all velocity distributions by these three numbers. Okay? And when you have a trimodal distribution, those three numbers are not enough to be able to describe that system. And you have that same problem in ordinary gas flows. You also have that same thing when you have Knudsen number issues as well, although that's not as strongly part of what's going on here.
You're indicating the mean velocity is right, but not the distribution.
Right. We do get the mean velocity right. The mean velocity is zero right here.
Okay. And even lower down.
Down here, we get it right. Because the nice lucky thing about a high Mach number flow is it doesn't know what's happening around it. Okay, it doesn't get to have feedback. So we can be wrong up here and still get it right down here.
No, but even in those regions, you may not get the velocity distribution function. Right?
The velocity distribution in these regions is essentially unimodal. So it's okay for both temperature and velocity. If we look at the actual velocity plots, so we can actually look, for example, at the velocity and the temperature. Let's see, I think this is the velocity. But we can look at the temperature as well, comparing between the Navier-Stokes equations and the molecular dynamics, and they lie right on top of each other. So it's quantitatively correct for both the density, the velocity, and the temperature. They're all basically the same. The distributions are not perfectly Maxwell-Boltzmann, but they're easily described by a width, a mean, and an area.
There's
Yes.
In the ordinary fluid, molecules are so small that we don't worry about the split when they are on the ground.
Right.
In this case, it's really crucial.
Actually, though, in this kind of case, you would have to worry about it even for gas. Okay, so in fact, in the elastic case, the slip it's almost pre-slip by this time, even in the elastic case. Now, it depends on exactly your surfaces. If it's just really like a piece of steel and argon, well, you know, then the slip velocity would be different. But for our elastic hard spheres, that slip velocity issue is exactly the same as for granular systems. Okay. But so this system is essentially the most ideal case. It takes one of the extreme situations of granular systems, high Mach number flows, and exploits that to make a very, very simple flow. This is why things like simple shear and Couette flows and Poiseuille flows are kind of hard. They, for ordinary materials, those are very simple flows, but Couette flow at Mach 5 is very different from Couette flow at Mach 0.001, which is when we normally think about it. So this was kind of an exploitation of the special case of granular systems in the high Mach number regime. So we wanted to try to look at a system that was much more general. And that system we started with was a rotating drum experiment. And again, we're doing this in 2D, so we can track all the particles with a digital camera. We have very high resolution tracking down to about 2 microns. The particles are about 1,000 microns. And so we have very high resolution tracking. We can look at these systems. And I'm not going to talk in detail about this experiment today, but if people are interested, they can talk to me about it while I'm here this week. But what we can do is things like extract the velocity field using a PIV-type technique. We can also zoom in on a small chunk and get the velocities of all the particles, calculate histograms, velocity distributions, and things like that. And from this experiment, we came up with three new experiments that we've been interested in lately, and I'm going to talk about one of them today. But I'm going to mention all three so that you know some of the other things that I'm interested in case people want to talk about those. And the first one is the boundary conditions. From the way that the fluid comes off the wall, we can tell something about the boundary conditions in that system. And one of the things is that the normal velocity is equal to zero is not applicable to granular systems. You can basically understand it with a very simple idea. The walls can push the granular system, but they can't pull it. Okay, so they can't maintain a velocity normal to the wall equals zero at all times. And we've done a lot of work in both experiment and simulation to show that that is true, that equation is not the right one for the boundary conditions for these systems. The other thing is that in that flow, the velocity distributions are nearly Maxwell-Boltzmann for any part that's really flowing. Okay, on the return flow, when everything is just kind of being carried back up, it's not true, and I'll talk about that, that's the next point. But in the flowing part, it's nearly Maxwell-Boltzmann. And that got us thinking about trying to do an experiment to look at homogeneous heating, which is something that people have done a lot, looked at the velocity distributions in homogeneous heating. And in that situation, what you have is they're near Maxwell-Boltzmann, but they have a sonine-type correction, just like you might expect from an ordinary fluid. And this is a much bigger deal than the fact that the tails are different. So a lot of the other people have focused on the shape of the tails are non-Maxwell-Boltzmann. But one of the things to remember is that the tails only represent a very, very small fraction of what all the particles are doing. There's actually a deviation that's much larger than that is appropriate right near the peak at the most probable situation. That's this sonine correction, which turns out to be very much like what you would get in a non-equilibrium system for ordinary particles. And so this is also something that we found to be quite interesting. In here, well, how are we in rapid flow? We can measure the temperature. We can measure the Mach number. When the Mach number gets really, really high, that basically means that the temperature is zero, and that means we don't have enough randomness in order to to.
Rotating drum is, you know, as a clearly solid underneath. There's solid body rotation.
Right. It's a highly sheared solid body underneath, so it is getting some heating. Yes, absolutely. It's a very, very complicated flow.
Yeah, it's complicated flow, but the point is that the really interesting phenomenon occurs right at the boundary between the solid and what people might call the liquid quote-unquote phase.
Right.
And what the distributions that you're using are good at doing is to see what's happening in the gas phase, but most of the flow isn't in the gas.
No, in fact, most of the flow is in this phase. I can show you after a picture of how what part of the phase is has maxwell boltzmann distributions, what part does not. And most of it, even the very, very slow flowing, even the part where there's a there's a stagnation point, even in that stagnation point, the velocity distributions are maxwell boltzmann. The temperatures are very low because there's not a lot of stuff, but the distributions are still maxwell boltzmann like in that region. It goes way deep, way past the, there's a flowing layer on top. If you look at this picture, you can kind of see the basic ideas that there's this flowing layer on top, okay, which most people look at. And yes, it has maxwell boltzmann distributions, but also as you go deeper, way down past, this is, it's hard to see in this picture, but there's this stagnation region here where the flow has to recirculate, has to go zero. It's maxwell boltzmann all the way through that and way into here until you get to the part that is truly just being carried back up. And even in that part, there's some fraction that's maxwell boltzmann like. So. These are steel particles, so 0.9-ish.
Is it isotropic?
No, the temperature is not isotropic. Nor are the distributions, yes.
So you are looking at the equivalence with a Newton fluid.
Yes.
You are in a Heimlich region.
Yes.
With a gradient which is large.
Yes.
So what means the Newton fluid in this case?
It means that the rheology is such that the stress is linearly related to the gradients of the velocity.
Because it's not obvious that the definition of the viscosity would be...
No, that's one of the things that we would like to understand. That's what people assume in the theory.
Okay.
And so since we have the right kind of distributions and stuff, that leads us to believe that. But actually one of the other things, which I won't even touch on at all, is that we are also making granular rheometers to actually measure directly what are the rheological forces in the system. So we're also doing that as well. Right.
And there's no correlation, long-scale correlation with mini grains.
Right.
And really that well, the region where these assumptions can be used.
Right.
Well,
I take my cue from what we do with ordinary materials. So for water, the correlation links are very, very large. Many, many molecules between, many, many molecules are all in contact, all interacting under the potential energy. And yes, we don't use kinetic theory to calculate the viscosities. If you want to do a simulation of Navier-Stokes equations on water, you don't go to your Chapman and Cowling and get out the viscosity to plug into your equation. You go to a table and get the viscosity from a table. And even though the viscosity may not be able to be calculated from currently tractable kinetic theory procedures, the underlying equations, the Navier-Stokes equations, are still true for water, even though they have these long-range correlations, even though there's many things that we can't calculate from kinetic theory, but we can get them from tables. And so the idea would be that if we have a granular rheometer, we get the inputs from experiment, we put them into the Navier-Stokes-like granular equations. A what? Well, I think this is something that is not established experimentally, and if that is the ultimate thing that we establish, then I will agree with you. But I don't think that is currently established by experimental investigation, and we want to find that out. Right. Absolutely. But the difference is that in turbulence, turbulence is not the same as molecular motion. And we have something that's much more akin to molecular motion than turbulent motion. And I think that's the main difference. And I think that the problem with ordinary or typical rheometer is that people do not take care of thinking about the granular temperature. They allow that to be something that's free, that is not one of the control parameters. In any rheometer, when you do real rheometry, you have to control the temperature in these systems. And so if you have a simple couette device, that's not going to give you, that you're not, it is going to depend on the flow, just like it would for an ordinary fluid. If you have a couette device, with some very viscous system that you really turn really, really rapidly and heat it up in the middle and it's cooler on the edges, it's not going to give you the right viscosity. It's going to depend on exactly how fast you're going and all these things. And so the idea is that you have to build up Just like we had to go to a very special flow, a high Mach number flow, an easy high Mach number flow to understand how the dilute system is working for these systems, we also have to find simple flows where we can extract rheological information. So that's the basic idea. Yes?
I wonder about the second point.
Yes.
I wonder whether it's a mean correction which had to be described for a 3D cooling.
Yes.
How are you dominant?
Yes.
I mean, these small deviations from the Maxwell, they come from a collective cooling of the gas.
Absolutely.
What I would expect is that the deviation from the Maxwell, which are induced by your boundaries, are much more dominant than these small effects.
Well, in these experiments, we are introducing a homogeneous heating of the system. So we're specifically trying to experimentally investigate what has been done both in theory and in simulations. We're experimentally investigating to find out if, in fact, in real experiments, if you can reproduce the same kind of thing. And it seems that you can. This is a separate experiment where we got interested because in the velocity distributions, the velocity distribution in the rotating drum do not have Sonnine corrections. They're just Maxwell-Boltzmann or very, very close to it. But because they're not really freely cooling, as you say, the boundaries are dominating the input of energy, and so they're not being freely cooled. They're being heated by the boundaries, and that gives you a much more Maxwell-Boltzmann-like distribution. But if you go to a case where it's uniformly heated, then that's where we see these Sonnine corrections.
Right.
The idea would be that maybe locally, we should be seeing some kind of Sonnine correction even in any flow. We should have to take that into account, that the base state is not really Maxwell-Boltzmann, but a Maxwell-Boltzmann corrected by Sonnines as the base local thermodynamic equilibrium or local non-equilibrium steady state. Okay, and then the final thing is that we noticed in the regime that you're talking about, in this sort of circulation zone, we see peaks in the radial distribution function which tell us that there's crystallization, okay, in the system. And that is one of the main facts that leads to a non-Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution in that recirculating zone, is the fact that you have peaks in the radial distribution function. What's that? These are monodispersed, so this is why we get a crystallization transition in this case. And that led us to try to understand in more detail what's going on in this transition from a crystalline state to a gas lake state. And so we set up a very, very simple experiment, which is essentially the granular analog of the PV equals NRT thought experiment from freshman physics. And that is that we have a granular gas, again 2D, and we have a plunger on top, or a weight, that's freely floating. Okay, so it has a frictionless piston, as we call it in intro physics. We have this piston that goes down. This sets a constant pressure boundary condition at the top of this fluid. Then below, you know, obviously for a granular system, if we just set it there, nothing just falls and that's it, we're done. But we have to input some energy, and so we use this plunger at the bottom to shake it up and down to input energy. And one of the things that makes this system a little different, this is a oft-studied system, but one of the things that makes it different is the presence of this weight, and it has a very homogenizing effect on the fluid. Okay, so if you imagine doing the same experiment, which you can do without the weight, then the pressure at the bottom is equal to the weight of the fluid, and the pressure at the top is zero. So the total pressure gradient across the whole fluid is equal to the pressure gradient that you have, the whole thing. So this is a very large gradient. Okay? As soon as I put a weight on top, now the pressure at the bottom is equal to the weight of the fluid plus the weight of this. The pressure at the top is equal to the weight of this. And now the variation in pressure around its mean is much, much smaller than it would be if you didn't have the weight on top. And so there's a parameter, which is the weight of the particles to the weight of the floating thing, which you need that to be about 1 in order to start to see this effect. If it's below that, then you don't see this because the weight is not heavy enough to give the homogeneity you need. And what happens instead is that you get freezing in one part without freezing in the other part. But in this homogeneous case, you're able to get freezing throughout the system. Okay. Now, we put a certain number of particles in, for example, 68 particles in our cell, gives us exactly 4 rows. And this is a very common thing to do in small systems like this, is to pick a number which is commensurate with the boundary so that you can not worry as much about the boundary effects, but I will talk about that in the end. And what we want to do is not think of this like a kinetic theory experiment, but like a thermodynamic experiment, okay, where we have reached equilibrium or a steady state. And in this ordinary experiment, you would have four state variables, your pressure, your number, your temperature, and your volume. But you would have an equation of state, which reduced by one, that number, and you can define essentially a volume fraction, which gives you the three numbers which define the system. And so if you fix two in an ordinary system, there's only one that's free. So if you do this in an ordinary elastic system, then you've fixed the pressure, you've fixed the number, and you, at any given temperature, we have different behavior that you can look at. That's the only free variable, is the one that you can change, is the temperature. In this case, we have another free variable because we have the energy flow. Okay, and we have to give some kind of thermodynamic meaning to that, and so we use a kind of a flux idea. And so our control parameter is the flux. It's fixed, but we're able to change it. And so both the temperature and the volume are free to fluctuate in this case, instead of just having one free to fluctuate like you would in an ordinary system. Now we can't measure, or well, I'm going to say we can't, but we're still working on measuring directly the heat flux. But we use as a surrogate the amplitude. And we used gamma because we came from that idea, and it's maybe not right. And we don't change the frequency that much. We've changed the frequency, but we don't look at it systematically. So as far as we're concerned, gamma is just the amplitude, okay? And we assume that the heat flux is monotonic with the amplitude. The higher the amplitude, the more energy you're putting in at a fixed frequency. So that's our surrogate for the heat flux, which we can't directly measure. We use a sinusoidal variation here, and the typical frequency we use is 50 hertz. Although we've changed it, it doesn't really make that much difference to the overall idea. Okay, so what do you see? What you see is a sublimation transition, okay? You go from a crystalline state to a gas-like state over a very, very small change in your control parameter gamma. Okay, so here we're at gamma 7.9, we go to gamma 8.1, and that's what you see, this huge difference in the state of the system. And we can summarize that on a diagram like this. Here we have the heating strength, or gamma. Here we have the volume fraction on this side. The volume fraction, when we start out at low amplitude, is at its maximum value. It increases as we start shaking harder. And at some point, it really starts to increase. And here we have a crystal, which is expanding because of heating. Okay, just like any, you know, take steel and you heat it up, it gets bigger. This is exactly what's happening. You can extract the volumetric expansion coefficient from this for this solid. And as you continue to go up, at some point, this is A here. And then when you just change it by a small amount, it jumps down to B, this system right here. So you have this huge jump in the density. Then you go up, you have a repeatable branch. But on the way back down, you have hysteresis, and it jumps back at a different volume fraction. Yes? In these earlier experiments, the piston could incline ever so slightly. It was originally thought that we would get less friction that way, if it had a little bit of freedom to move that way. Since we've determined that actually it's better for it to be perfectly straight, the presence, you may notice here, there's a little kink in this return. That's due to the fact that at this point, the thing could just incline ever so slightly to allow a little part of it to crystallize on one side, but not on the other side. But that is an issue, but it's not, when we fix that, it doesn't change anything that I'm going to say. That actual inclination doesn't change anything. So if you go like I just described, this is considered fast, okay, in this system. And it's just like what happens when you heat something up fast in an ordinary system. You get hysteresis in that case. Yes?
How do you measure the temperature?
We measure the temperature by measuring the position of every particle, extracting their velocities, and kinetic energy per unit particle. Well, so that's an interesting question. There are three, there are four frames that you might think about. One is the lab frame. That one we can ignore. We know why that one isn't going to work. The other frame would be the center of mass of the gas. That's one possible frame that you could look in to measure the temperature. The other would be the frame of the bottom plate, and the third one would be the frame of the top plate. Okay, all of those frames might be interesting to look at the temperature in those frames. You can see the problem is that if it's a perfect crystal, and I'm raising it up and down, but the particles aren't moving in that reference frame, a measure in the lab frame would give you a temperature. Okay, but there is obviously no temperature in that case. Okay, so we've got to take account for that issue, otherwise our temperature won't go to zero like it should. What's that? In the gas, all those frames are equal. They're very close to equal because in the gas, this small variation is very small compared to the variation up there. There's not, in the gas, it doesn't make a difference. Any of the frames I pick give us within our experimental error. Not experimental error, but the fluctuation of the temperatures is much larger than any difference that it makes as to whether the whole thing is moving or not in the gas state.
What's the maximum
time? Yes.
What is the maximum time?
What is it made of, or?
No, the mass. What is the mass?
How much is it? It's roughly equal to the weight of the particles. Approximately the same mass as all the particles.
So the pressure at the bottom should be twice the pressure. At the
that's right, and if you go with a gradient larger than that, then you start to see a differential cooling. You see it either freezing on top or bottom before.
But you should be able also to see a gradient of temperature.
There is a small gradient in temperature. There's a gradient in temperature and density, and we use the mean for both of those.
And the gradient is about
The density gradient is very, very low. The temperature gradient is also relatively low. The pressure gradient is the largest one. Okay? And that's a factor of two. Yes?
What is the scale for granular temperature? Is it mega
or? The scale for the granular temperature is in particle diameters divided by. It's in gravity. The scaling units are gravity and particle diameter. So it's square root of GD.
Okay. And it's not tied to like there is another velocity scaling problem, which is the shape of velocity.
Right. We have not systematically explored that by change. We have to change the frequency to explore that. And that's something we would like to do is define, for example, we use the gamma as the surrogate for heat flux. We'd like to directly measure the heat flux, find out what the heat flux as a function of gamma and F is. That would then tell us how to relate. And ideally, if it's a thermodynamic system, it's Q that it depends on, not A and F. So any combination of A and F that give you the same Q should give you the same thermodynamic state. And that's something we would not check, but we would like to check in that system.
This
is a hard sphere system in a confined hard sphere system.
So the rate of pressure equation for that, all the variable coefficients will be independent of temperature. Because there's no other scale in the problem.
Well, that's an interesting question. In principle, if there were no gravity and they were really, really hard, you're absolutely right. I don't know whether for the real experimental system there's gravity, which sets an energy scale, and there is actually, at some point, the temperature gets low enough. That's what this little kink right here is. At some point, the temperature gets low enough that the temperature alone is no longer enough to hold the plate up. At that point, elastic energy is holding the plate up. And then there has to be an energy scale based on the elastic energy of the particles.
Once we're getting the transition,
yes,
the elastic energy
is absolutely irrelevant.
In the rotating drum,
is a very, very hard problem. Absolutely. That's why we keep simplifying to these others, to try to see if we can treat the rotating drum locally like any of these problems. Just like that's how ordinary Navier-Stokes gives us turbulence. Very, very complicated thing. But locally, we know some very special things about it, and that's how we get there. This is the approach we're taking. See if we can locally come up with the right analogies so that we can think about granular flows like the rotating drum, which is very complicated, has freezing, melting, high Mach number flows, low Mach number flows, has all that stuff in there. That's one of the reasons we use that as our kind of hub of the wheel of things that we're looking at. You know, that's the experiment we like to describe using fluid dynamics. And we're looking at various simplifications of that to try to understand it in detail. Yes.
It's very difficult to measure temperature accurately at large densities.
Yes.
It has to do with the frame rate of the camera.
Absolutely.
The resolution one has their trade-offs that actually prevent anybody from going to an arbitrarily low uncertainty in the measurement.
Absolutely.
You know, that pixel resolution can
yes.
be interpreted as an oscillation in the velocity, which actually doesn't exist.
Right.
Yes.
Let me say a couple of words about that. I know we're kind of running late, but I'll just say a couple words about that. One is that we have looked at that in depth. And we're confident that for all the temperatures that, say, above here, that we have no problem measuring the temperature. Below there, maybe there is some questions. We have a very sophisticated algorithm for getting subpixel accuracy that we've tested in detail. And so we're getting subpixel accuracy down to about a 40th of a pixel in these things. And our particles are about 40 pixels across. So we have a very, very high resolution, 2 micron resolution out of a 1 millimeter particle to get that. So a very, very high resolution allows us to get these kinds of measurements. The biggest drawback, which we will fix starting now, we just got a new camera that can go 10,000 frames a second instead of 1,000 frames per second. That's the time issue that will help us to get a little bit further down. But of course, as you know, you can't go arbitrarily low, but you can continue to improve yourself by doing various things. Yes. If you have that, when the collision frequency is greater than when the collision frequency approaches the frame frequency, then you have a problem, because once you break that barrier, you no longer know what happened in between. We actually do have a crude way of working with that, because what we actually do is we don't just go from one frame to the next. We actually use a molecular dynamics simulation to take us from one frame to the next frame. So we actually can interpolate in between some small number of collisions. When we're not using that for this because it is not needed, but for some other experiments that we're working on, we need that kind of precision. So we actually find a valid molecular dynamics path, including collisions, from one frame to the next. Now, that's not guaranteed to be the right one, because there could be many, many ones that possibly go through there. But what we find is that it tends to give us the same result no matter how we run it. So we think it's relatively reasonable, but it's not something we have to do for this case. Okay, so that's for fast flow. Okay, you have this hysteresis. Okay, when you go fast, when you ramp the thing up fast. So if I put water in a microwave oven and I heat it up very, very rapidly, you may have had this experience where you have it in there for like 3 minutes, it's not boiling, you're like, what's going on? And then you reach in, you touch the thing, and all of a sudden, boils over, right? This is superheating of a fluid. And this is what's happening in this case. On this side, we're having a superheating of the crystal, and then we jump down here. On this side, we come back, we're having a supercooling of the gas, and then finally it jumps back up. No. That can happen in... surface tension can play a role, absolutely. But even in a perfect hard sphere system, you can have this hysteresis if you go fast enough. Okay, and it's just due to the fact that there's a certain, essentially latent heat, that it takes a certain amount of time to actually break the thing apart. And if you go faster than that, if you go faster than that time, you won't break it apart at the given situation. It's kind of a way of saying you're out of equilibrium, essentially. Okay. Now, this is a very common thing in nonlinear science, and you see this a lot, this hysteresis, like in the onset of convective patterns and things like that. In those cases, no matter how slow you go, you get that hysteresis. It's just built in. It's just part of the nonlinearness of the system. In this case, it's just like a thermodynamic system. If I go slower, the hysteresis goes away. So the red curve is a very, very slow approach. And you can see both up and down are shown on here. Okay, so it's perfectly repeatable if you go slow enough, just like it would be for an ordinary thermodynamic transition. Okay? Yes?
Can it be an effect of the bottom, of the top, of friction on the
We can measure the acceleration of the top plate. And what you find is that by far, the most probable acceleration is 9.8. So we don't think that friction is playing a tremendous role in the top plate. We've done various things. We started with these that have more of a gap on the edges that gives you less contact. We've gone to ones that have more, which presumably have some more friction, and it doesn't change anything. We haven't tried to make the friction really strong. That might be something to try, is to make it even stronger to see if it has an effect on what's going on. We also see this, just one sec, we also see this in our simulations where we have no friction. So, as well, yes? The fast and slow. Yeah. Yes.
Because you didn't find a black body, it's warm enough to break the surface. This is the idea in the ordinary fluid.
You can get the same thing without a surface.
Well,
like in a gas.
Without a surface, it's a bit surprising. And I what I can understand is if you heat so quickly that the collision of a collision time scale, the system is out of equilibrium. But this would mean that the radiation release is a very small fraction per second.
The time scale in this problem is long. The one that takes you from, so here's another experiment you can do, which we're also doing. You can come and sit right here. Okay, so if you sit right here, you should expect that it should fluctuate between one state and the other. Okay, and it does, but over many, many minutes. It is the entropy. It's a excluded volume pressure. Just like you can get. I mean, this is all entropy driven. It's totally entropy driven. It's not energy driven. So the surface tension is just not. I mean, we can talk about it more after. But I really don't think the surface tension is an issue in this case. This problem is a free energy, free volume problem. It's not a free energy, but it's like a free volume problem. And it's just like the excluded volume in a. The force that you get, the depletion force you get in a colloid or something like that. That's the work that has to be done to break it apart. That's where the latent heat comes from in this system. I think if you we can discuss this further, but I think that if you have a system without any surface tension, then I think you can get the same effect without it, but. I don't know. I mean, maybe we should discuss it further.
Maybe an adequate discussion.
Yes.
Isn't dissipation the dominant thing here, that you should overcome the dissipation which you have in the volume that contains
matter? I don't think so. The dissipation is very rapid. I don't think that the time scale is way too long for that. I think. I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, we're in a steady state. There's always dissipation, always energy entering the system. So.
Let's discuss
it. Yeah, we'll discuss it later. Okay, so we see all the same effects that we see for an ordinary phase transition of this type. Now let's talk about some things that are different. Okay, first of all, the granular temperature is a tensor. Okay, so there's a different granular temperature in each direction. Okay, and therefore there's also different pressure in each direction. So we're setting the vertical pressure, but the horizontal pressure is not being set. So that's one. When you're setting the volume, if you like, in that other direction. But volume doesn't really have a direction, so it's kind of hard to think about exactly what's going on there. But you can see on this plot, here are the vertical temperature and the horizontal temperature both shown. And now here comes the other different thing, and this comes back to the fact that we have a new thermodynamic variable, another state variable, namely the heat flux. The temperature also shows a first-order phase transition. Okay, the temperature also shows a first-order phase transition because it's not fixed. The only thing that's fixed is mechanical equilibrium. The pressures have to be the same of the two states. Otherwise, one would invade the other, or you wouldn't change states. So the pressures have to be the same, but we don't have conservation of energy, so the temperatures do not have to be the same. Okay, so the temperature is free to fluctuate, and it does. It jumps. And in fact, not only does the temperature jump, but the ratio of the horizontal temperature to the vertical temperature shows a first order like phase transition. So in the crystalline state, only about 20% of the vertical energy is getting into the horizontal direction. In the gas state, about 50%. And this just goes up. It just keeps going up as far as we've gone. This is 14 gamma. We've gone up to about 40 or so. It's around 0.75 up there. So it just keeps going up. So the harder you heat the gas, the more isotropic it eventually becomes. You might think that, but having this plate on the top really makes a big difference in terms of the homogeneity of the system. There's not a huge variation in temperature from the top to the bottom of the system. Okay, so that's the differences. Now we can also look at the equation of state. And to do that, we need to look at the, how long do we want to go? I mean, I don't want to, just till 11 and or so, or do we want to go, or are we done? Because I don't want to. Okay, all right. So you'll leave when you're done. Okay, all right. So we have the crystal and the gas state, right? And we can look at the radial distribution function for this system. Here's the gas radial distribution function. You can see it's a very liquid-like radial distribution function. Okay. Here's the crystalline state. It has huge peaks at 2, at square root of 3, square root of 7, 3, etc. It has all the peaks that you expect in a crystal structure. Okay, but the one that's important for the pressure is the one right at contact. Okay, the radial distribution function as a function of density at contact, and that's what tells you how much extra pressure there'll be due to volume exclusion. Okay, and that's the thing that's important, and so that's something that we can measure directly from this data. And so what we expect for a dense gas, an ordinary dense gas in 2D, is that we should have PV equals nRT, just like always. But for a dense gas, we have a correction chi. Okay, and that correction for 2D is equal to 2 times the area fraction times the radial distribution function at contact for that density. Okay, and that's what you get for an ordinary elastic hard sphere gas. Now, when we translate that to the granular system, the first thing we need to do is to think about the temperature. Okay, what temperature should we use? Okay. Normally, in ordinary systems, we use the trace of the temperature tensor. Okay, but that's not the appropriate one here, because the horizontal temperature plays no role in holding the plate up. It's only the vertical temperature that plays a role in holding the plate up. The horizontal temperature is irrelevant, at least to the extent that we ignore friction with the top plate. There could be some issues there, depending on rotations. But if there's no rotations and we ignore friction, then that's not an issue. So we want to put the vertical temperature in here. Okay? And the other correction that has to be made is part of this 2 comes from just carrying momentum from one place to the other. But the other part of it comes from collisional exchange of momentum. So if I have two particles that collide, their momentum jumps from one particle to the next. Some fraction of their momentum jumps. Some of it is lost in an inelastic collision, so you have E here instead, coefficient restitution instead of 1, which you would have for an elastic gas. And so you'd get 2 if this is 1, just like you get for an ordinary two-dimensional gas, but you have 1 plus E for a inelastic gas. Now, the radial distribution function, we can measure the radial distribution function at contact from our data. We can also get a theoretical measure of the radial distribution function, like from Carnahan and Starling, or from Torquatos, or from Luding, or et cetera. There's a number of these theoretical or computational versions of this function. So we essentially have two ways to measure chi in this equation. We can measure it directly from the experiment by inverting this equation. We take the pressure divided by the mass of the particles times the number of particle density divided by the temperature minus 1. That thing should be chi. We can also get it from here, alpha times the density times g of that. And we have two ways of measuring g, so we have two ways of looking at this. An experimental way and a theoretical way. Okay. So first, let me just show chi itself. Okay. So the thin line is Torquato's calculation of chi using Carnahan and Starling below 0.7 or something. Above, he's using a molecular dynamics simulation to get that. The solid line is the experimental values that we get for chi, using the pressure and the number and that sort of thing. And so it's a fairly good agreement. And an interesting thing is that it works. There's some kind of equation of state, good equation of state, even into the crystalline regime. Here's the transition points along these two thin lines. So there's some kind of equation of state. Now, we wouldn't expect that it should actually line up necessarily with what's done for the hard sphere gas, because we've actually crystallized, we've changed states. But there's clearly something that works in this regime, which needs to be calculated. Beyond that, when you see here, this just goes up to infinity. And at that point, temperature is no longer enough to hold up the gas. There has to be another contribution to pressure besides temperature. There has to be some kind of elastic contribution to the pressure that holds up part of the gas at that point. And once we get to that, then the equation of state no longer works. But that's well into the crystalline regime before that occurs. They're very, very high densities. I mean, this is the maximum packing fraction that the thing can possibly attain, which is a little different from what you get in an ordinary system, because there's extra little volume around the outside edges because of the small size of the system. Now we can measure alpha in these two ways, because we have our measure of chi from the experiment, but we also have two measures of g, one experimental and one theoretical. Okay, so we can measure this alpha, which should be 1 plus e. If we look at the theoretical one, where we put in Carnahan and Starling here, we get something that's slightly above 2. So it doesn't quite work quite right. The g of phi is not quite right. On the other hand, if we use the one that we get experimentally, it works quite well. And we see some things that we would expect, that E should depend on the volume fraction and things like that, that there's actually some dependence there. And this number is less than 2 in some reasonable amount. This is should not really be E of an individual collision, but it's some kind of bulk E process, because E depends on velocity and a lot of other things, so it's some kind of averaged E that goes into this. But it's very, very reasonable what we have there. The scatter is from, it's not a theoretical curve totally, sorry. It's the chi, the measure of chi is experimental. And we're comparing it with the theoretical G. If theory was perfect, this would give us something that looked like down here, like what we would expect. Theory is not, it's telling us that the G of phi that you get from theory is not exactly what we're getting in the experiment. This may be very well due to the fact that, you know, we try to make it 2D, but it's not quite 2D. So there's a little bit of room for particles to slide behind. So the apparent density may be a little different from the actual density of the gas. That may be the total effect. When we measure it directly, though, we measure G directly, then we see that we get what we would expect.
So I don't quite see that. So the theoretical value of G is therefore smaller than what you need to put in experimentally.
Right.
Does it go the right direction?
Yes, it does. It's smaller, see?
I understand that you observe that. I'm trying to understand why it should be smaller.
Oh, you mean, is it? Well, I don't totally understand how that apparent density might, I mean, I can come up with an argument for actually both ways, for the way that apparent density works, because it could depends on exactly what's going on in that third dimension, which we have absolutely no idea what's happening in that third dimension. So,
yeah. In the 90s, in the early 90s, I did simulations.
Yes. Yes.
And so I regard, so I regard all the attempts to fit simulations at higher Born fractions are is essentially a way to come up with an average mean or something. It's not single value. If you take a certain path, it'll go, and you are getting, in fact, phase transitions that occur right there.
Right.
So I don't really, to the right of your blue line.
Yes.
Are we really using any single value if you want to?
So what I would say is that if you also take into account the state variables and determine the state from the state variables, if you get to the same state variables, I'm going to expect that you get the same G for always. But what's happening when you go into different paths, you get this hysteretic effect, and you get to a different, you get to a place that's not in local non-equilibrium steady state. Just like you'd say it was not in equilibrium. It's not there. And if you wait long enough, or if you, maybe you can't wait long enough because it's stuck there, but this is the same problem we have in glasses. I mean, I'm just trying to get us up to the point where we're the same as fluids. I'm not necessarily saying let's try to get beyond, and eventually we'll have to. If we want to understand these things, we're going to have to go past what people have done for ordinary fluids. Just like in the high Mach number flow, it's very clear that if we want to go any further with that, we need to understand something that people who do high Mach number flow for a living do not understand yet. So if we want to go beyond that, we have to do something new. And I'm just trying to get the rest of granular system up to that level where we're at least as good as fluids, you know, or find an absolute contradiction that tells us we can't do it. And so far we haven't found an experimental absolute contradiction that tells us we can't do it. So we just keep pushing further and further, trying to get to either a contradiction or to the point where we're like, where we can understand these things like ordinary fluids. Okay. So I was going to talk about one other thing, and I'm just going to briefly talk about it now, and people can talk to me about it later if they want. And that's what happens if you change n, the number of particles that are in the system. So if we go from 4 rows to 3.5 rows, we see that this, here's the density, and you see there's no phase transition in the density when we go to 3.5 rows. And we took us a while, but now we finally understand what's going on there. And what is basically happening is that you can see it in this picture. Here's 3.5 rows, 4 rows, 4 rows. These two are at the same temperature. And this one is crystallized. This one is somewhat crystallized. But if you look at its radial distribution function, that's the blue case, doesn't have nearly as big a peak at 2, has very little peak at 3. It's not as crystallized. And what we found is that, in fact, it has some fraction crystallized and some fraction not crystallized. And so it's in a coexistent state where some of the particles are in crystalline structure and some of the particles are more free to move around. And the basic problem is this. Even though we're at the same temperature in these two cases, we're not at the same density. Because the top plate can't conform to the surface of this gas, okay, there's no way for this thing to get to as high a density as this one at that same temperature. Because essentially there have to be four guys going up to here. And so this plate, which can't tip or fill in those areas, and you can clearly see, you've got these big gaps in this region. The density is much lower here than it is there. So you're not at the same thermodynamic state. And in fact, where you are is in a state where you've fixed the volume to be between the two volumes, which represent the jump in the hysteresis. So you're actually forcing the system to live at a volume that it wouldn't live at if it was free to change its volume. Okay, so we're essentially constraining the volume. In that case, you actually get a lever rule, just like you would get for an ordinary system. If you force it to be at a certain volume, even though it doesn't want to be, you get a lever rule. And here's the percent melted that the thing is. And all of our data either jumps across this gap, or maybe has some hysteresis coming into this gap and then jumps, or it smoothly, that's the blue and green curve, smoothly goes between like a lever rule, so that when you force it to sit at a volume halfway in between, you get half melt, half solid. Now the weird thing is there's no surface tension between these two, so it doesn't spinodally decompose. You know, it just coexists and they can live near each other without any energy consequence of having a boundary. There's very little energy consequence of having the boundary, and so they can coexist there. So let me just conclude here that we have a lot of evidence now that granular materials behave like ordinary fluids, but in extreme conditions like high Mach number and these phase transitions, I like to think of them as supersonic, easily melted dry ice. Okay, so you know, that's the kind of situation we're in, which is a tough situation to be in. Even if that was absolutely true, it still means it's hard to solve these problems. Okay.
Why is a supersonic condition?
These are two separate things.
Oh.
It's high Mach number and near phase transitions. So not only is it high Mach number, but it also has phase transitions that are very near. It's high Mach number because the particles are moving with velocities that are much larger, much faster than the time it takes to propagate information. So if you push on the fluid, it takes longer to get information to go than it does for the particles or for objects to move in that frame. We can talk about it after, but the other thing is that we have this first order phase transition, which is just like a first order phase transition in ordinary materials. It's a sublimation transition. It's a non-equilibrium steady state, so it's not an equilibrium phase transition, but it has all of the macroscopic features of that. It has discontinuous jumps, it has rate-dependent hysteresis, there's an equation of state that matches up, the melting equation obeys Lindemann criterion, which I didn't talk about, but we have a lot of data on that. The phase is determined by the state variables, okay? And I think this is important. The phase is determined solely by the state variables. So we can ignore the granularity of the system, and if we look at state variables alone, we can determine the phase of this system. So it's just like a phase diagram for an ordinary system, even though it's non-equilibrium. And this fact that we have all of these things, the fixed volume of A's lever rule, all of these things, suggest the existence of some kind of free energy-like functional, because if you have a free energy-like functional, you get all this stuff. So we have all this stuff, so there should be a description of this system in terms of a free energy functional like you have in an ordinary system. So thanks for your attention. Yes. Yes, the last sentence. Slipped it in. Try to slip it in at the end.
You get all this in half disk, half sphere systems without the free energy function. It's not a first order phase. Okay, there's a lot of controversy in literature whether it's a first order phase transition or a continuous transition.
Right.
But everything that comes after that, you get it in half sphere, half disk systems.
Right.
You change the volume without any free energy function.
Well, there's some free energy-like functional that you have, that it's a, be a free volume function. It's an entropy. It's an entropy. I don't mean free energy like it's energy. I just mean some function is being minimized here. And if we knew that function, it would tell us everything about this system. Sure, for elastic hard spheres in equilibrium. Yes, but this is out of equilibrium in a non-equilibrium steady state. Okay. Good, interesting. In a perfect hard sphere,
yeah.
Zero gravity system, yes. Not.
Well, fully approximately.
Well,
okay, not zero gravity, but gravity is not a state value, right?
Right. Right, but it sets an energy scale, which, you know, if there is a. It sets a time scale to the problem, which may be important. It may tell us about the time scale that it takes to. In terms of constituent relations, it doesn't matter. I agree. But what I'm saying is that there should be some kind of minimization principle that gives us this this whole structure. Because this whole structure can be.
You can get a continuous transition which looks very close to a first order.
Okay, that's fine. Either way. To me it doesn't matter whether it's that or that. I mean, I'm an experimentalist. This looks like a first order phase transition to me. If I was back at the time of, you know, whoever discovered the first order phase transition, you know, if I was back at that time and I just had a box and I start heating it up and all of a sudden something quickly changes, I'm going to call that a first order phase transition. Now, if theoretically you tell me I can make the same construct that where it's really continuous, okay, that's fine. I don't care. But it says to me that there is a theoretical construct where we can use the thermodynamic ideas in a non-equilibrium steady state. Okay, which is different. Yes, you can say it works in an equilibrium system because there's a lot of theory behind that. But the fact that it also works in a non-equilibrium setup, I think, is an important statement.
I wanted to ask a question about the rate-dependent hysteresis.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So you observe a hysteresis as a function of gamma.
Yes.
But it's not at all clear that there's also a hysteresis as a function of Q, because if you do, because the energy input from a vibrating plate can have more than one non-equilibrium steady-state energy. And in fact, with Jerry, we've done experiments where you vibrate a plate above 1G, and there's a state where they barely bounce with very low horizontal energy. And then
right.
There's a second state where a lot of their energy is in horizontal modes.
Right.
And that is the.
I mean, one thing that I would like to determine, and I don't know the answer to this yet, is, you know, in those two states, for example, is the actual energy input from the plate different or the same? If it's the same, then
the energy input is different.
Okay. Well, so then they're at different Qs, and so you expect a different state.
Right. So in your hysteresis, you might have a transition.
The Q might be changing. The Q might be changing, but I mean, the amplitude is still getting bigger, and this position of the transition can be changed by the pressure. So if we put a different weight on top, we can move it around. So it doesn't have anything to do with the particular gamma we're at. There's different transitions for different gammas. We really need to do that experiment. Something we absolutely want to do is to prove or discover whether or not the Q, if you give me a Q made by any means, do I get the same state? And that we have not shown. It would be nice to show, but we haven't shown that yet. Well, it's not inevitable because the dissipation is different in the two states.
The way you couple the system, I mean, if the system changes state, like this, it really is coupled to down.
Well, I mean, that's the question is, so is that change the dominant thing or not? Right. And I'll say that we have some preliminary data. So what we can do is we can look at the particles near the boundary and ask what's their velocity before they hit the boundary, what's their velocity after the boundary. That tells us what the energy input of the boundary is. And we don't see any major changes in that function. We're still working on whether that we... averaged. Averaged over the whole thing. So the average flux of energy in does not seem to show any... I can say almost certainly that it doesn't show a first order like behavior. It may show a kink, may show some kind of second order behavior or some change, but we have not seen yet that it shows any kind of large change in the behavior.
Why should that be the first order transition also for the input? Because when you have the temperature which is different.
My answer would be that locally the thing can't tell the difference. between the two states. It's not that much different, the two states, and it just can't tell the difference. It's just hitting particles. And
the speed is larger, and it can go deeper and then get more energy.
I could see how it could be. I just, so far, it's not, there's no big change in that. Yes, of course.
And that in turn has a consequence on the way that the
Yes, absolutely. And it has in the crystalline state it shows a motion that's similar to the motion of the top plate, really, is the thing it's most like. It's similar to the bottom plate, but it's more like the top plate. So the center mass and the top plate seem to go together in the crystalline state. In the gas state, though, the center mass does not show a peak in the Fourier transform at 50 hertz. It should change it somewhat, but whether it changes it in a huge amount, what we can do, once we can really directly measure the Q, is we can measure that on the fly, and we can force the Q to change incrementally and look and find that phase transition. So that's our ultimate goal, is to measure the Q on the fly and use Q as our control parameter. So we will force it. We'll change the amplitude as needed, in order to make the Q the same in both states.
So you have to change the weight for the control frame?
No, the weight will stay the same, but we will change the way that the shaker shakes.
So
this is just how you would control anything. You know, you say you only have one control parameter with temperature, but then if you really want to control it, if something is happening, so if you have an ideal temperature bath. If you have an ideal temperature bath, then you change the temperature, and it doesn't. What happens in here does not affect. Okay? But if you had a real temperature bath, like you just have a block of copper, when I change the state up here, then the heat flux is going to change into the system. And if I don't have a really, really strong bath here, then I will change what happens in the bath. This is what we're saying is going to happen. I'm saying what I do, if I have that problem in an experiment, what I do is I either put heat in or take heat out of that thing to match whatever the system is doing. In other words, I match the impedance, just like a resistance problem. So, you know, I'm gonna force the Q to be the same at both states.
If that's the Q at the lower boundary, you may be still coupling very differently at the upper boundary.
The upper boundary doesn't supply any Q. It's part of the system. No. So it's
going out.
Of course it's supporting some better Q.
So it should be going out aligned with
it. Yes, but
the
sidewalls as well, yes.
It's not
yes.
Clear if you can control Q really independently.
Yeah,
whether it makes sense that it makes sense if you will.
I see what you're saying. You're worrying about controlling the Q at the top plate.
Yeah.
Well, one thing is that we see this all happening in our simulations with no Q at the top plate. Yeah.
Well, there's inelastic collisions at the top plate.
Well, in our simulation, we don't actually do that.
Oh.
Yes, we could put it in there, but we haven't. Put it in there yet. Experiments, we have it in there, but in simulation, we don't. So, yes, sorry. I'll be here all week.